This is Martin Dormish, and I would like to welcome you to my very first ever podcast. So this is the Everyday Epics podcast, and I'm excited to be doing this. It's a little bit of a new venture for me, so I'm learning how to use some new software and lining up some guests to interview, and wanted to give you a little bit of an overview for what to expect in my podcast this month and moving forward. Basically, it's going to be a reflection of my blog, which is everydayepics.com. I cover on my blog a lot of different things, different features of things that are happening current event-wise in the world, as well as topics that include theology and hermeneutics and history. My interests are pretty wide, and so I'm going to try to create some interesting conversations that hopefully will be worth listening to for you, and that will be enjoyable for me too. You know, it's mostly for me to talk to people that I enjoy or that I'm intrigued by, and to learn myself, and hopefully you will be able to do the same. So today is March 16th, and this is one of my favorite times of the year because I'm a basketball fan, and today is really the more or less the beginning of March Madness and the men's NCAA college basketball tournament. And yeah, I've been watching this since I was a little kid and just love this time of year. It's exciting. It's better when my team is in the tournament, and I'll talk a little bit about that in a minute, but it also in some ways is kind of better for me when my team is not in the tournament, because there's less pressure, there's less stress, and I can just kind of enjoy the games and take the surprises and upsets and everything as they come, since I'm not so emotionally invested in the games. So I'm really looking forward to the next couple weeks and watching some basketball. And there's also too, in the same sort of vein, talking about sports, the next U.S. men's soccer World Cup qualifier is coming up in a couple weeks. And that's pretty significant because last fall, the U.S. Replaced Jurgen Klinsmann, who had been the coach for more than one World Cup cycle, and hired the former coach Bruce Arena, and he is hopefully going to shepherd the team through World Cup qualifying this year and help them to qualify for Russia 2018, which will be the next World Cup. So those are two sports that I follow pretty closely, just because I really enjoy basketball and soccer. I played basketball growing up and a little bit in high school, and played some soccer until high school, but didn't really become a soccer fan until later in my life when my family and I lived in Spain. Because if you didn't like soccer there, then you basically had nothing to talk about with anybody. So I've been following soccer pretty closely for a while, and my oldest son is also a soccer player. He's on a competitive team here in Broomfield, and so we go to a lot of his games and practices and stuff like that. So that's a part of our lives. And it's something that we really enjoy. But going back to the basketball issue, I am really excited because the last basically 48 hours have been kind of like a resurrection, or at least it feels like my favorite college team, Missouri, is being resurrected. And from the ashes of the worst three-year period of seasons in my lifetime. We have won fewer games than at any other time that I've been alive, which is really sad and hard because Missouri is a basketball school in a lot of ways. And having gone there and still feeling a lot of loyalty for Mizzou, it's been hard to watch our basketball team struggle so mightily for the last couple of years. But we now have a new coach, Konzo Martin from Cal, and he's been a couple different places, but I'm excited about what he will bring to the table for the basketball program. And there are also a lot of rumors in the works about possible recruits that could be coming to Mizzou that would have the potential, at least, to really turn things around in the short term, rather than having to wait long term. So I'm very excited to see how that turns out. But this isn't meant to be a sports podcast. I just wanted to kind of introduce a couple things that were on my mind right now as I'm leading into my interview. But one thing that I thought would be kind of fun, too, to add to these podcasts, in addition to just talking about what's on my mind, things that are going on current event-wise, and just topics of interest that I care about, like history and literature and theology and that sort of thing, is to tell a story. And this is, obviously, you won't be able to get the full benefit of this, but you can at least hear me tell a story. I thought I'd kind of introduce this feature as part of the podcast moving forward, and we'll see how that goes. But it'll be kind of the Everyday Epics story time during the podcast. So I'll tell a story that's 8 to 10 minutes, and this really fits into something that I've begun doing here in the area over the last year. As I was trained as a storyteller through a local nonprofit, which is a great group. And I'll have to talk to them to make sure that it's okay to share their name and everything on my podcast. I'm sure it will be, but just in case, I won't mention their name right now. But I've been telling stories at a local school that my wife teaches at, and have really enjoyed it. It's been really helpful for me in learning how to be a better communicator, and it's just fun to interact with kids in that way. And I've learned more about story in that whole process. So, welcome to Storytime on the Everyday Epics podcast. I'm going to tell a story today that is based on a book that I read years ago that I love. And I will tell more about the story after I am done to give a little context for where it comes from. So, long, long ago in a faraway land surrounded by a great ocean, there lived a young man named Sukkot. He was the handsomest and smartest of his peers, young, wealthy aristocrats all, sons of the leaders of Roman and Prydian. They lived lives of leisure and made no apologies for it, but though they hardly realized it, the world around them was changing. One night, as Sukkot and his friends were on horseback returning home from their favorite tavern, they found their normally sleepy town and its outlying estates, outbuildings and all, in flames. Scores of strangely dressed warriors crisscrossed the village with torches and spears, chasing screaming men, women, and children. "Wait!" cried his friends, but Sukkot ignored them and raced into the melee. He hoped to find his parents, hoped to help somehow, and so he weaved his way through the chaos until he reached his father's estate. It, too, was burning and was being plundered. And before he knew it, Sukkot found himself attacked and unhorsed by the strange warriors. He fought valiantly, but one of the attackers whacked him on the head with the butt of his spear, and everything went black. When Sukkot awoke, he was in chains, in a boat, next to groaning men and women and children who he recognized as his neighbors. The boat bobbed up and down with the waves and made Sukkot sick. After what seemed like forever, the boat landed, and Sukkot and the rest of the captives were led out onto a beach. A fortress loomed over them. Other captives lined the beach, and before long, each of them were led before a makeshift stage and auctioned off. Sukkot was purchased by a man of some authority who wore a torque, a necklace of twisted gold around his neck. Sukkot pleaded with him and tried to make himself understood in Latin, explaining that his father would pay ransom to earn his freedom. But the prince, or whoever he was, seemed not to understand Latin. Sukkot's increasingly desperate pleas fell on deaf ears until finally a hot iron torque was placed around his neck, burning his skin, and he was hauled away. Thus began Sukkot's life as a slave. His new lord and king, Miliuk, assigned him to help his head shepherd tend the many sheep that belonged to Miliuk. numbering more than the people under Miliuk's care. 3 times Sukkot tried to escape the island of his captivity, known as Ayre. 3 times he was caught, and the last time Miliuk's warriors beat him nearly to death. "If you escape again, when we catch you, we will kill you," they said. Then when Sukkot proved himself adept in the new tongue, he began to win over those of goodwill who lived near where he served Lord Miliuk. He made friends with Miliuk's bard and with the attendant of Miliuk's queen, and soon his charisma and intelligence became obvious to all. So Sukkot became an advisor to the queen. Each time she went to buy from the trading ships that plied the coast during good weather, Sukkot went with her and negotiated good prices for her. This Sukkot did for many a year, until one day he decided it was better to die than to be a slave one day longer. So he hid a bag of provisions, and he followed a trading ship to its next stop, striking a deal with its captain. Each day the ship sailed farther from Miliuk's land, and each day Sukkot helped the captain trade with the local chieftains. Each night the captain took out a file and scraped off some of the back of Sukkot's iron torque. Many months later, the crew set sail from the island of Ayre, much richer than when they had arrived, and they were bound, in fact, for Sukkot's homeland. And to mark the occasion, the captain filed through the last bits of iron, breaking Sukkot's torque in two and destroying that token of his slavery. However, after Sukkot landed on his home soil, he found things very different than when he had left. His father's estate, his village, and even his favorite tavern had not been rebuilt. They were abandoned. He sought for word of his family and friends for many months until he learned beyond doubt that they had either died or been taken captive. Bereft, lonely, and afraid, for his sole purpose had been to return home, Sukkot lost his way. And though he retrieved a large chest of gold coins hidden in a secret hiding place behind his father's crumbling hearth, his life held no meaning for him. Then, one day, Sukkot had a dream. He looked and he saw a seashore, and on the seashore walked a shining, princely-looking man with fine clothes and a green and blue checkered cloak and a red gold torque around his neck. On his shoulder he carried a leather bag filled with scrolls, and as he approached, Sukkot called out to him, "Who are you, Lord?" "I am Victoricus," answered the man, and withdrew one of the scrolls from his bag, handing it to Sukkot, who unrolled it. And suddenly he heard a voice cry, noble boy, come walk among us again." And the voices became a multitude, pleading with him, and he recognized them as the voices of the people of Miliuk on the island of Ayre. Their words pierced Sukkot to the heart, and tears streamed down his eyes, and then he awoke. Then and there, Sukkot decided to return to Ayre, and so he disguised his golden chest and caught a sailing ship for the land of Miliuk. And when he arrived, he felt he had truly come home. And messengers went before him, and all of the people gathered to see what would happen. And when Sukkot appeared before Miliuk, Miliuk asked, astonished, "You know it is death for you to return here, do you not, slave?" And Sukkot responded, "Lord Miliuk, I well know the penalty for an escaped slave, but I have come to ask your forgiveness and to pay the honor price." "So you have returned to mock me with your wealth?" asked the king. "Not at all, Lord Miliuk. I have brought twice the gold you paid for me to redeem myself from slavery, and twice more to pay you for the loss of my services while I have been away." The king deliberated with his advisors, and he said to all, "Because this slave has honored me by acting justly, I forsake the death I vowed for him. I accept this gold as payment for his services, and I give him his freedom." The people surged forward with acclaim and welcomed Sukkot as a kinsman. And so Sukkot found his true home. and soon after he found his true calling, to bring hope and life to the people of Aire, now his people. Everywhere he went, the people remarked at him, the slave who became a free man and a messenger of one he called the King of Kings. Sukkot, of course, is a strange name, but you might know him better as Patrick. Saint Patrick, to be exact. And you might know the island of his captivity, Aire, as Ireland. So that story is one that I condensed from a very much longer story that I really love, a novel by Stephen Lawhead, which is called simply Patrick, Son of Ireland. It's a great book, and I highly recommend anyone reading it. So I had to change some things and condense things, but that's one of the stories I tell right around this time of year because tomorrow is St. Patrick's Day, and so I thought that would be very appropriate. So I hope you enjoyed story time for the month of March 2017. So I want to extend a welcome to my very first podcast guest, my good friend Chris Bulligar. Welcome, Chris.
It's good to be here, Marty.
So today we're just going to have kind of, we talk a lot. We're friends, like I said, and we have conversations about life and theology and sometimes sports and all kinds of different stuff, and we're going to try to replicate one of those conversations today, and hopefully you all, whoever is listening to this, all five of you maybe, will enjoy something that you hear here. Yeah, so Chris, why don't you start by telling everybody about yourself, like what you do, and...
So, I'm an Anglican priest, currently serving in a church in Broomfield, Colorado, called Holy Trinity Anglican Church. We are part of the Anglican Mission in the Americas. I am a father, married, husband, father of three, and also a student at Iliff School of Theology, and I have another year or so to complete my Master's of Theological Studies. I don't know what else you want.
No, that was good.
Okay, good.
The reason why I asked you that question first was because I wanted to see the look on your face, and now obviously everyone listening to this can't see the look on your face, but we just recently had a conversation about over the years how difficult it's been for us to answer that question when someone asks us, so what do you do? You know, normal small talk conversations, and I'm not the world's best small talker. I would always really struggle with that question because I do a variety of things. I think the common contemporary term for my sort of career and vocation is I have a boutique career. You know, it's made up of a bunch of different sort of things.
Yeah, I like that.
And so, yeah, it's only been recently that I've finally come up with something that I feel more comfortable with, that I can tell people, and it doesn't stress me out like it used to.
So, is that how you frame it? Saying,
well, I've used that a couple times, but mostly I just say I'm a minister of community service in Broomfield, and I help people that are living on the margins and in my area.
It's much easier to say what I do or to answer that question around people, obviously in a faith community or they're familiar with Christianity, but absolutely it is much harder for me to find language to communicate because it just feels like there's so much baggage tied to the language of priest or pastor or minister, and I have not figured that one out yet. Because usually the conversation ends as soon as, you know, somebody asks or it gets really awkward or they withdraw, and that's no fun. So I haven't figured that out. So
I haven't really
still
either.
Still searching.
It's right. You're right. There are different audiences, you know, that you have. If it's people that are in your normal circles, it's easier.
Right.
But when I'm at the gym, when I'm playing basketball, I don't say that I wouldn't give that explanation unless someone asked me specifically what I do. I would just say I do nonprofit work.
Right.
So I actually had a guy in the locker room a couple months ago when I told him I do nonprofit work. He's like, nonprofit work? I'm into profit work. I want to make money.
Nice.
So, yeah. So he gives me a hard time every time I see him now.
How's that nonprofit work going?
Yeah, very good.
So, now that we have introductions taken care of, I want to say a few things about you, because so when you're interviewing a guest, you talk up your guest, and so
usually before they're here.
I'll probably do that a little bit when you're not here, but while you are here, I'm going to say that Chris is, like I said, he's one of my best friends, and I admire him for many reasons, but one particular reason that relates to hopefully what we'll touch on today a little bit is he's a very deep thinker, and he's very smart, even though he might not acknowledge that. And I think he could be, if he wants to be, and he might be now, on a trajectory that's going to take him toward earning his PhD, which I think would be a great thing, because he has a great mind. And it's not just that he has a great mind, but he also has compassion for people. And so I'm excited to see where he will be headed in the future. I'm excited to read the things that you write. And today, hopefully, we'll touch a little bit on some of your stuff that you've learned in seminary. But as we've had conversations recently, I've been very excited and encouraged about what you're learning, because I can kind of ride your coattails and you kind of do all the scouting and research for me on the front end, so that I have an easier time on the back end. Cause I think we're a little bit different in one way, in that I think I'm more of a generalist, and I like to know a lot about a whole bunch of different things, which means that I can't get very deep into things. With you, get very deep into theological things that go way farther than I could go, or have an interest to go, or the ability to go. But because you do all that scouting for me, it's a big help to me. So thank you for all of your recommendations and for sharing your journey that you've been on with me. It's meant a lot to me. So,
well, you're very kind, and I would say where I see our big difference is that I think you're a better Christian than I am. So that's not self-deprecation, but I'll just leave it at that. I think.
Okay, well, that's very kind. Yes, not true, but it's very kind.
All right.
So my first question, I listened to your last sermon, because I have a unique position where I get to listen to all your sermons after the fact on the podcast, and you pronounced a word differently than I've been pronouncing it for years and years. So that's the first question I have for you, is how do you properly pronounce the word Hasmonean? Is it Hasmonean or is it Hasmonean?
Oh.
So this refers to an era of time in the history of the nation of Israel, or the Jewish people, where there was a particular royal dynasty. It was before the time of Christ, and but not that far before the time of Christ, and plays a significant role in some of the cultural context and background of interpreting the New Testament and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And so Chris has been in scholarly circles recently, and so he mentioned that word in his sermon, and I was like, wait a second, I've been saying Hasmonean for years and years, but you are the scholar, so what is the proper way to say that word?
I honestly don't know. I'm using English, well, the way I learned phonetics, you know, that there's the O is made long because there's one consonant and a vowel follows the consonant, so... So that's why I pronounce it that way. And I think that's probably just the way I heard it. The words like that are intimidating to me, because I don't know, and I haven't been in enough settings yet to hear people that I would say, yeah, that person knows, and I can follow that. So yours sound actually, how'd you say it?
Hasmonean.
Yeah, I like that one. I don't know. I honestly don't know the answer to that question. Hasmonean or Hasmonean.
Could you ask one of your profs?
Sure.
You can ask Pamela Eisenbaum.
Yeah, I could. Mm-hmm.
Did I say her name right? Is it Eisenbaum? Eisenbaum.
Again, that's how I say it. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
See, there's all these.
There's a great plug for Professor Eisenbaum at I Love School of Theology.
Yeah. So why don't you talk about her? I know she's a professor that you've taken recently in a class, and you were talking her up. She is one of your latest theological crushes. I think it was your term, and so. Why is that, and what makes her so special?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I just got through with a class on Romans, which is a class that she teaches at ILF, I think every other year. And the uniqueness, or the thing that I found attractive about Pam's reading of Romans is the way she addresses Paul's, the way she conceptualizes Paul's main intention in writing the letter, and that has a lot to do with who the audience is. So one of her kind of insights, and she leans heavily upon the work of another scholar that was at Brown, I think, named Stanley Stowers, and who makes the case that Paul's audience was exclusively Gentile, that he's not writing to a community that is primarily made up of Jews and Gentiles, and therefore the issue that Paul's addressing in Romans is not trying to you know, help those Jewish Jesus followers and Gentile Jesus followers come together in some harmonious way, but rather that there are among this Gentile Jesus following community in Rome, there are those who are teaching that the Gentiles must submit to Torah in order to be faithful to even this new messianic movement. And there were others that were saying, no, you don't. And Paul is actually writing in that context. And what Stowers and Professor Eisenbaum both do is really also, not only that, but draw heavily upon the Greco-Roman context and not just the Jewish context that would have been at work in Paul. They view Paul as a thoroughly Hellenized Jew. And so he would have been at some level aware of and utilizing and interacting with, you know, the world of his day that he would have known. And so that's really helpful. I made a comment to her like the second week in class, and I said, you know, I've read the traditional kind of Lutheran view reading of Paul. I've spent a lot of time trying to understand the new perspective and all its various kind of manifestations, which we can talk about what that means if we want to.
Mm-hmm.
And these are just different ways to read the letter to the Romans. And what I said to her was, you know, I cannot get around both of these positions. These kind of family of readings rely heavily on the Jewish kind of tradition and world. And I said, I read Paul as very Greek. And she said, you got to read Stanley Stowers. So I got his book, A Rereading of Romans, and it's been really helpful. It's worth the read. It's definitely worth the read. And
can you, for those listening to this, can you kind of summarize the main, you've already touched on it, I think, a little bit, but can you summarize the main point of that?
The main gist,
Stowers book?
I think the, maybe a good way to do it is to compare it with a more traditional, like what I understood in my kind of formation into Christianity, what I was taught and how I read Romans for so long was in a kind of traditional Augustinian, Lutheran. Paul's main point in Romans is that he's trying to combat this, you know, this impulse to want to earn salvation, you know, and so works of the law is interpreted as basically applying effort, you know, towards salvation. And Paul is saying, no, it's all grace, you just receive it. So
Ephesians 2.
Yeah, Ephesians 2. Yeah. So it's by grace that you're saved, not through works.
Through faith.
Through faith. Mm-hmm. And so it's this active principle and passive principle, and that's really what Paul's wrestling with. And I think what Stowers is saying, no, that's not what the issue that's happening here. The issue is that, as I said, that these Gentiles were being told that they needed to submit to Torah in order to be faithful to the Jewish God. They were being grafted in through Jesus and by Jesus and into this vine of Israel, as Romans 9 through 11 says. And there were some that, you know, this was an issue in the early church. Well, what do we do with Torah then for these Gentiles?
Mm-hmm.
And Stowers
is saying,
do they
need to become Jewish?
Do they need to become Jewish? Mm-hmm. And Stowers' main point is this is a Gentile question, not a Jewish question. That Paul isn't saying Jews need to abandon Torah. He's saying don't make Gentiles have to submit to it. And so that's why Paul goes back to Abraham and makes these arguments of, hey, Abraham was reckoned righteous prior to receiving circumcision and the law, and therefore that's a sign of what the Gentiles were ultimately going to be doing.
Right.
So it in a way preserves the integrity at some level of continued Jewish observance of Torah, but also a way for the Gentiles to be grafted into this tradition that allows them access to the God that the Gentiles or the nations never had access to, but was promised in the prophets.
So would this be why you referred to her perspective and Sowers', is that right?
Sowers'
perspective as a genealogical theory of atonement? I think that's coining a new phrase that might, that could be your PhD right there. Right?
Yeah, I told Professor Eisenbaum wrote an article and she assigned, she's very kind of humble in her scholarship. She only assigned this one work of her own and she's published a lot. But the one article that she assigned was, it was actually on Galatians 4 and it was dealing with being, I can't remember the title of it, but how to be redeemed from being born of a woman. So she's addressing this problem of heredity and lineage, patrilineage, or your lineage being marked by the father, which you see over and over again, and how this actually works or worked in the Jewish mind and tradition that it was always through adoption, even through, and it's an intricate argument, and I would actually have to go back and revisit the article to be able to reproduce it here, but the main insight was that Christ's death, as it's presented there in Romans 4, is actually something that brings about the adoption, that's kind of the main point. It's a way to connect us into the lineage of Abraham, which is the point. It's the faithfulness of Abraham and Christ's faithfulness that is one with the faithfulness of Abraham, and we're being grafted into this family by adoption, and Christ allows that to happen to these Gentiles who have for the most part not had access to this God. And so I went up to her and said, hey, I think you might be on to a new theory of atonement something like a genealogical view, and I certainly haven't worked that out, but I was just trying to be playful and creative with the idea, because it definitely helps you to approach, at least as it's presented in Romans 4. There's certainly other passages you'd have to deal with, other versions of the atonement, but in Romans 4, to talk about, this is really focusing on what the problem is. They need to become part of the family of Abraham, and how does that happen? And it's through this ultimately kind of a circumcision in one sense. That brings us in. So again, I'd have to go back and my memory fails me a little bit at this point.
No, I think that's your PhD right there.
Yeah, right. I thought about it.
Because, the atonement is in the circles that we've been in for many years, primarily evangelical circles, and even before that, I think we both have had exposure to kind of more fundamentalist views of following Jesus. The atonement's very important in those worlds, and a particular view of the atonement and a particular way of reading passages, letters like Romans and other passages in the New Testament and the scriptures in a particular way. And so I think, for me, I think it's eye-opening, and I think it's a great thing to see that there are still, even more, after all this debate that has taken place over generations, there are still more ways to look at the work of Christ.
Yep. And it really, I see it as, in a sense, even though it does depart from the Lutheran reading at several places, for me anyway, it's staying true to a certain aspect of what Luther was after, I think, in seeking and trying to find a gracious God. That's this kind of impulse, I think, in why I, as a Christian searching still, that's the impulse, you know, trying to find and discover and construct ways of thinking about a God that's gracious to us. Yeah.
So now that you've brought that up, how have you encountered that God in your studies at ILEF or at that particular institution? And there are obviously many different seminaries, many different schools of theology, different places people can go to study the Bible, to learn more about their faith, online, on TV, on the internet, you know, I guess I said that twice, online, on the internet. What makes, why did you decide on ILEF, and what do you feel like you have learned? How have you encountered God at this seminary who, you know, honestly, growing up, I grew up in Denver and in that area, drove by DU and ILEF many, many, many times when I was growing up. And the view I had of ILEF School of Theology then was that, that's a dangerous place. People, they're heretical there. They don't really believe in Jesus there. So obviously you have a different perspective, and I do as well now. But so, yeah, if any of that, you know, is attractive or not.
Yeah. So when I was considering, actually, it was as I've been playing with the idea of going back to school, and this was several years ago, to work on another degree, and my wife was also contemplating a master's degree, and I kind of pushed her to say, you should go to ILEF. There's two schools here in the Denver area, main kind of seminaries, or, you know, ILEF's a school of theology, but that train ministers. There are other smaller institutions, but the two big ones, at least in the Protestant world, are Denver Seminary, which is much more evangelical. I think it was started as a General Baptist, or
has some sort of Baptist affiliation. I don't know, though. I have never attended there.
And I think it's expanded to include and to become much more broadly evangelical. And then there was ILEF, which was kind of serving the mainline denominations. And of course, we've got the Catholic diocese here, and they do their own thing. But so when I was thinking about schools for myself and my wife, those were the two options. And, you know, having been in the evangelical world for so long, I genuinely just wanted to be somewhere different. I wanted to think differently, to engage with the scriptures and ways of thinking about theology that were different. And I knew that they would, at ILEF, the way their method of doing theology would be very different, the way they approach history, the role that history plays, sociology and sociological principles, science, you know, the relation to that is much more, they're much more willing to include those kind of disciplines and perspectives in their theologizing than what I suspected would be a Denver Seminary. But I've never been there. I know people have gone there, and it was no slam on them. I'm always looking for difference and to be in that place. So that was one element of it. The other element was I don't like the division. You know, I mean, there's the deep divisions that I've experienced in the church. In almost every faith community I've been in, there's been splits and divisions. Though I understand why, and I've been involved in those conversations, I just don't like it. There's something in me that just, I don't like it. And so I wanted to go kind of to the other side of the fence and just listen and learn. So the original question, how have I found a gracious God in that context, is, in some sense, though I never was made to feel like this by anybody, because I come out of this conservative kind of background, I felt weird there and I felt alien there, you know, but I did that purposefully because this is a mainline denominational church. They're very broad, multi-faith, socially, kind of the big moral issues, you know, that they're facing our culture and the church, they're on a very different side of those issues than the communities and tradition I've been a part of, but up to this point. And so I felt very alien, but there's a deep acceptance. I mean, it's a weird... there's a valuing of difference, even the kind of difference that you know they perceive that maybe I have. And so I have felt a genuine inclusion and, you know, and that's... There's a graciousness to that, and it's a broadness and a generosity of spirit that has been really good. So that's one aspect. And they're heavy on critique. This is another point. They're heavy on critique in some levels and wanting to, you know, like a lot of us do, deconstruct and you know, question where we get these ideas and show how everything is contextualized and relativized. And so the critiques are another place where I've encountered God, because it upends, you know, it disorients. And in that disorientation, there's a strange, I don't know how else to talk about it other than a strange kind of sense that you're, or for me anyway, a sense that I'm being drawn into something. It's not just questioning for the sake of questioning, but there's a crisis, this Greek word is where we get this idea of crisis, and it's translated in our New Testament oftentimes as judgment. And that idea, God does that, you know, at least in my understanding. And so there's an experience of God disorienting us in order to break us open so that there might be new life that emerges and all those things. So I've experienced that there, and it makes me smaller in a really good sense, you know, kind of like that feeling you get when you're in an ocean and you feel small, but there's also a sense, for me, there's a sense of just great wonder and awe and peace at the magnitude of something that large. And so I've been able to, the faith and this relation to this deity has become big, very big. And that's a, that can be scary, but when you realize you don't fall in that big, broad place, that you actually can grow and thrive, it's a freedom. It's a different kind of freedom, and it's good. Yeah.
Well, I think ILF Seminary should make a little clip of that and put that on their website. That's good. Yeah, I mean, there are many avenues we could follow from stuff that you've said, because this is very typical of our conversations. Chris mostly does the talking usually, and he's saying profound things that I want to follow up on later that I think are, that's part of the reason why I wanted to share his insight with everyone else. And so there's so many different ways that I could go from here, but we'll just move on, because this is meant to be more of a kind of an introductory podcast where I can figure out how to do this. And I'm sorry, I want to apologize for all the noises that you probably have heard during this, because I'm not quite sure how to turn things off, and I don't want to turn off the audio on my computer and then you not be able to hear what we're saying. So I'm just gonna leave it like this, and there'll be extra sounds and that sort of thing this time until I get this figured out. But so tomorrow is St. Patrick's Day. Hmm. I like St. Patrick.
Yes.
I think many people like St. Patrick for different reasons. They might like green beer, or they like to wear green on that day so they don't get pinched. That's always been my tradition from when I was in school as a kid. Always make sure you wear green so you don't get pinched. But, you know, obviously there's far more to St. Patrick's story and to the story of saints in general. And so I thought this was an interesting topic to bring up. Just the whole idea of saints, depending on your tradition that you grew up in. If you grew up Catholic, then saints are a very important part of, you know, living as a faithful Catholic and you know, as intermediaries to help you in your relationship with God, even, and different things. As examples, you know, Protestants would see the lives of saints probably more as examples to follow of people who've been faithful to their Lord in different ways, and sacrificing or being martyrs or that sort of thing. Or in being exemplary, like, you know, Mother Teresa's. Has she been canonized, or she's in the process?
She's beatified. I think there's like a ladder, you know, all that you gotta climb. Yeah, right.
Different stages. Yeah. So, you know, I grew up thinking that saints were not necessary. You know, you shouldn't pray to a saint because you pray to God and that sort of thing. But I think that was a little bit of a misconstrual of the purpose of saints. And I know that saints are more important in the Anglican tradition than, you know, most of the traditions that I've been a part of. There's another sound. I keep getting emails. So tomorrow's St. Patrick's Day, and I thought I would ask you just in general about saints. I know that you're not an expert on saints necessarily, but why do you feel like saints are important, or how can they help people in their walk with God, or just in their lives in general?
Yeah,
this is like a catechism question.
Yeah, it is a catechism question. Saints. So, yeah, I would say that my I'll give kind of a history of my relation to this, if that's all right,
as sure.
my way of answering. So very, you know, I wasn't raised a Christian. I wasn't raised in any religious tradition at all. We went to church a few times, you know, younger. But it was around 16 or so that I was first kind of making a conscious decision to identify with the Christian faith. And the tradition, or the sub-tradition within the broader Christian tradition was Baptist, and it was, you know, non-sacramental. There wasn't really talk of saints, other than in the sense in which, like Hebrews 11, you know, it's kind of these heroes of faith. So Hebrews 11 is you know, this chapter in the letter to the Hebrews where all these saints from the Hebrew Bible are listed as, you know, being exemplars of faith and faithfulness to God. And that's the way we viewed them, you know, was these saints were great people, examples to follow, which is the way Hebrews talks about it. As I migrated into the Anglican tradition and my thinking began to become more sacramental and thinking about God's grace being able to be communicated through created substances and all of that kind of that goes with sacramental ideas, You have this idea of the saints and the role of the saints. And we say it every Sunday as we recite the creed, that we believe in the communion of saints. And so, you know, I had to become a deacon in the Anglican Church and a priest. You have to answer all of those questions theologically. And I did all of that and tried to come to some type of understanding about all of that. But as a part of my own journey, there was that kind of the theological part, but there was also this experiential part that I was going through without really seeking it. I wasn't really interested in, you know, the saints or anything like that. But I've had a few experiences where it felt like to me my experience was that there were others. And there was a communion with, and for me particularly, the saints that I've had those experiences with are Joseph and Mary, and strangely Dominic, Saint Dominic, from, you know, the founder of the Dominican order,
who is,
you know, the kind of twin pillars of, at least as I understand, the Dominican order is contemplation and proclamation. You know, their sign is the OP, the Order of Preachers. And this was, you know, Thomas Aquinas was a Dominican, Meister Eckhart was a Dominican. And so that tradition, I've felt an attraction to that kind of life of contemplation and proclamation. So the saints for me have had an existential personal impact, where I feel like a genuine communion is there. To justify that theologically for Protestants and evangelicals, which is what I came out of, you know, I had to work through that. And just to say very simply, without getting into the weeds on it, that one of the fundamental teachings, as I understand it, of Christian spirituality is that we are baptized into the death of Christ, into the body of Christ, and we become the body. We find communion with one another by the Spirit in the body. And that body has died and it's been raised again. And so we are alive in Christ, all of us. And so if we are alive, then how can death, this great chasm, this great enemy, actually separate us? And so it's a kind of a realization of that passage in Romans 8, you know, death can't separate us from the love of God. Well, there's a love that holds us together as united in Christ. And there, it seems to me that there are ways to not only experience that through faith and belief, but even as we reflect upon it, that it kind of makes sense to the own internal logic of Christianity. You know, outside it kind of can look weird and bizarre to people that, you know, haven't been quote unquote initiated into the reality, but it's from the inside, there's a certain kind of logic to it, it seems to me. And so I've been very free to be open to that and to feel at one. And so to ask for prayers from the saints, or seeking, you know, some Catholics talk about seeking help and benefits from the saints.
Mm-hmm.
It can obviously get wrapped up with ideas of merit and, you know, benefit. And I haven't really gone in that direction so much, but certainly at a level of communion, there's a sweetness to it that it's different than what you and I share, but at some levels it feels the same as well. So talking a lot about feelings, so
a feeling kind
of guy. I don't know if that comes from my kind of pietist background, or the more I kind of interact with Schleiermacher and, you know, coming over to the kind of liberal side and being instructed, you know, learning from them, he roots religion in feeling and mm-hmm. So,
religious experience.
Easy religious experience. Mm-hmm. So, on both sides, I suppose you can speak with some confidence. Yeah,
I like that.
Yeah,
my encounter with saints has been a little different because I was born into the Catholic tradition, and so my family has a unique faith story. But there was always a kind of an underground thing of Saint Anthony was always kind of around, because you would lose things, right? And then you'd be like, oh, dang it, I need to find my keys,
right?
And so even though, you know, some my family members were no longer practicing Catholics, that was always kind of, you know, thrown around.
Yeah.
So but more recently, you know, as I, you know, when I was an adult, I started reading, and you know, it's always dangerous to start reading widely.
Yeah.
If you want to maintain a specific tradition or way of understanding things, you have to read pretty narrowly. You have to stay within a, you know, particular, within the boundaries of that tradition if you don't want to move.
Yeah.
Because as soon as you start reading more widely, then the fences kind of come down and it's all over. So anyway, I started reading more widely, and one of the really fun things that I would recommend to everyone listening, that, you know, is a safe thing, I think, anyway, a safe recommendation that's very entertaining and very, I think, what would be the word? It's very, well, it's worthwhile, is the work of Stephen Lawhead. Stephen Lawhead is a fiction writer who is an American, but he's lived in England for many years. And he's more recently moved into kind of science fiction fantasy stuff, which I don't quite connect as closely with, but he wrote a whole series of books on saints and on myth, and I really love those books. There are a couple books in particular that relate to this discussion. One's called Byzantium that he wrote many years ago. That's really good. It's kind of his fictional accounts based on the life of Saint Aidan, who is a favorite saint of mine, mostly because of that book, but also because after reading that book, I was able to go to the place that he helped found a monastery in England. It's called Holy Island, or the Isle of Lindisfarne, which is totally cool. I'll probably talk about that more later. But I was able to make pilgrimage there, and it's a wonderful story about someone following the call of God on their life and doing amazing things. Mm-hmm. And you can still see the ruins of the abbey. Actually, I think it was probably after his time, but the ruins of an abbey that's built on that island in part because of his work there, coming from Ireland and being a part of the whole Celtic Christian movement of missions in the 7th century.
Yeah.
And so he wrote a book about that that's really engaging, and then he also wrote a book about the life of St. Patrick, which I have kind of, it's, you know, the book is 400 pages long. It's a really good book. But I condensed that into like a 10-minute story that I've told to school children on, you know, right around St. Patrick's Day, which is really fun. And I just like the way he looks at the lives of real people. And, you know, obviously I'm sure he makes things up based on his research into that era.
Right.
But he has a way of making the lives of people really appealing. And so St. Patrick and St. Aidan have meant more to me after reading those books than before. You know, they weren't really on my radar, but so I would recommend those books to anyone listening. And even to teenagers, they're kind of adventure stories. So I've recommended them to my oldest son, who's now 12. And he's just now getting to the place where he kind of enjoys that sort of thing. Moving into that. And Stephen Lawhead has also written books about legends of King Arthur and Robin Hood, which are really, really good too. So, so there's a plug for that. Some of my favorite books. But I mentioned my oldest son. This is the last. I want to try to keep this first podcast to around 45 minutes or so. And so we have about 4 or 5 minutes left for this main podcast part. But both of our sons, well, you have 2 sons.
Mm.
I have 2 sons. My oldest son and your youngest son play soccer.
Yes.
And so I thought it'd be kind of fun to talk about being soccer dads. Because it's been really interesting. Both of us have athletic backgrounds, played sports as kids. Sports were really important to us. You actually ended up playing baseball in college. I only played through high school, but I still enjoy playing sports now. And I, you know, taught my kids to enjoy sports, especially my oldest son. And it's just really interesting being in that world for the last, 4 or 5 years.
Yeah.
As he's gotten older and now he's on a competitive team. And so is your son.
Mm-hmm.
They're on different club teams in this area. But it's just really interesting. And then, he just recently started refereeing for the first time.
Nice.
Which is really cool. I was very proud of him for, even though he's not really that old yet,
mm-hmm.
he's kind of taken that on, and he did a great job in his first game. But it was something very interesting, and this is leading toward a question, but at the game that he refereed, there was a sign on the side of the field, which if any people listening to this have gone to recreational or competitive soccer games in the last 5 or 10 years, you probably have seen something like this. There was a sign, you know, in the parents section that said, your son's performance is not doesn't determine your worth as a parent, or something like that.
Right.
I took a picture of it so that I could post it on my blog, which I'll do, but those signs appear pretty much everywhere now that we go to watch games. And it's a really interesting thing that I've been thinking more about, because sports have been so important to me in my life. And now being kind of on the other side of it, getting older and having a son who's, you know, kind of getting into the most serious part of his sports career as a kid.
Right.
I feel like in some ways I've wasted most of my life rooting for certain things and putting so much emphasis on winning in competition. And I'm not to the place where I'm like, you know, everyone's a winner, everyone gets a trophy. I'm not there. But the emphasis and all the attention and money and time that we put into this just has really made me think lately. So I wanted to, you know, just kind of throw that out there as a point of discussion. Like, what's your perspective on on your son's involvement in soccer and just that whole world? It is a world unto itself.
It is. Wow, that's a big question. There hasn't been too many games. There have been a few where parents go back and forth at each other, you know, because they get frustrated, yell at the ref, making a bad call, you know, and then these kind of passive aggressive, you know, statements to one another, you know, and
coaches.
And to be honest, that makes me laugh. Like, I just sit there and smile whenever I hear it. It doesn't offend me or bother me, because I genuinely like competition and I love the emotions that surround it. I mean, I actually like combat sports. I know for someone who has pacifist sympathy, you know, it's weird, but I like the bravado. I see it as kind of theater. And I mean, obviously there needs to be boundaries at some level, I suppose. And they're kids. But there was one week where it was like parent silent week. Did you guys have this? Like where
I don't think we've had that for a long time, but some other people have been talking about that.
We had it in the fall season. So we play a fall season, a spring season. In the fall season, they had one Sunday Saturday where they said no parents can talk at all.
Coaches too, right? Coaches, no coaching.
No, it was so everybody had to be quiet and you know, because they didn't want parents yelling at their kids, coaching the kids, and so the kids coached themselves basically for this one game, and the parents couldn't talk. And there were some parents that, you know, couldn't hold back and kind of yelled, but it was relatively mild. And I went through, I think, probably the full spectrum of emotions. At first, I was like, this is the stupidest thing I've ever seen. Why are we doing this? You know, this is part of it. It's participatory.
It's like Lent.
Yeah, right? It is like Lent.
Lent for soccer parents.
Yes, give up. Yeah, give up your cheering or your coaching from the sidelines.
Give up your codependence on your kids for one game.
And so I do get annoyed by seeing the dads that are trying to live through. I don't like that. I'm not I don't appreciate dads who seek to try to live through and almost kind of they're rough on their kids, you know, really rough. I get it as someone who's competed, but at the same time, I like the competition and everything that goes with it. I can watch pretty much any sport. I don't really follow any except one. But I enjoy competition. It's just, I love human competition.
So that's really interesting. Well, that doesn't surprise me to hear you say that.
Yeah.
I've heard you say similar things in the past. You just like, sometimes you like rooting against people if they're rooting for a certain team. You've done that to me in the past. Right. I'm rooting for a certain team. I really want to win. And you just to be a dick or right. whatever. Okay, so if I, you know, sorry I said a bad word here. Just to be mean about it right. or whatever, just to be ornery, you will root for the other team, which really pisses me off.
And hence why I do it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So,
yeah.
But, yeah, I just... So, at this game that my son was reffing, there one of the coaches for one of the teams was just over the top, too aggressive and too... He kind of just was ripping on his kids the whole time, just yelling really loud. I mean, carried very clearly... And he was yelling at the parents. He was yelling at the parents not to say anything to the kids, which, you know, I get that. You know, coaches don't want the parents telling the kids something different than what they're being coached to do. Right. I get that. But it was like a rage. This guy was just over the top. And my son was standing next to him for most of the game because he was on the opposite field from the parents, next to the teams. And he was... You know, it was really obvious that this guy was just losing his team. His team, it didn't seem like they were really responding very well to his coaching, which is kind of a separate issue, I guess, you know, the effectiveness of it. But right. just over the top yelling, and, you know, you could hear him say some bad words under his breath.
Yeah.
Anyway, the reason why that stood out to me is because I can see myself in that guy, I yeah. think. You know, as I've reflected on it, I really easily, I'm not a very patient person, so I lose patience with my kids when they're doing their homework and they don't get it, and I'm like, this is yeah. so simple, how can you, you know, and I'm not very good at that at all. So I've had to take myself out of that role. But I can see myself, you know, I've tried to coach a team, and I couldn't do it in a way where I would be healthy and it would be a healthy environment for the kids.
Yeah.
So I see that and I'm like, ah, crap. You know, that's kind of, I can see myself going that far. Because when you're competing, at least for me in my experience, you get into it and you don't want to lose.
Yeah.
You want to train the kids to be able to deal with adversity. You mm-hmm. want them to be able to not give up when they're behind. Or, yeah. you know, there are all kinds of things that go into that. But ultimately, like, what difference does it make? I mean, yes, learning perseverance, learning endurance,
learning to work
hard, learning how to lose, learning to work hard. Well, that's the thing. I don't think this guy would have been a good loser. If they had they ended up winning the game, but if they had lost the game, I don't think it would have gone well.
Right.
It's just one of those things. Yeah, I mean, there's just a lot rolled up in that. So I'm kind of, you know, I'm in middle age now, which is hard yeah. to acknowledge. I noticed my first two gray hairs in my whiskers
Ooh.
A couple weeks ago.
Good for you. Wisdom.
And that was hard. Thankfully, my hair's kind of light, so you can't see unless you're, like, really
two?
Close. So, well,
that's
two for now.
Yeah.
I blame my kids for that and my wife. No, just kidding. But anyway, so I'm just kind of revisiting my, you know, for many, many years, I was like a really passionate fan, and, you know, I've cooled somewhat, but then I see my son mimicking some of my behavior, and mm-hmm. that makes me feel bad.
Right.
Because it doesn't seem very healthy. And so anyway, I'm just trying to be a healthier person. And seeing those signs, the fact that those signs have to be there is significant.
Yeah.
It's that parents, you know, go way too far sometimes. Parents on our team sometimes have done that. And, you know, I have felt myself being on the verge of doing that, so I have to walk away.
Maybe it's just because St. Vrain FC is just better than...
Than Broomfield? No, not possible. What, you want to take it on the field?
Yeah.
So, anyway, so I am very thankful that you took time today
out of
your schedule to come and have a conversation. There are many, many things we could talk about and just go on all day, but we don't have time for that. And so I hope you've enjoyed listening to us just jabber. But I hope some other time you'll come back and we'll talk about something else. Like,
yeah,
there are
fine.
So many topics I think that would be beneficial for people to hear about, like hermeneutics. Like, what is this about reading the Bible and interpreting the Bible? And is it just, you know, just believe what the Bible says, or is there more to it than that? Mm-hmm. And anyway, lots of other topics. So.
Absolutely. That'd be great.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you.